Hi, I'm David Sirota, investigative journalist at The Lever, Oscar-nominated writer on the film Don't Look Up, former Bernie Sanders speechwriter, and host of the chart-topping news podcast Lever Time. Each week, our team of reporters at The Lever exposes the events, news, and corruption that often go unreported by corporate media. So if you're looking for a podcast that goes below the surface, listen to Lever Time every week wherever you get your podcasts.
The face-to-face tomorrow between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. Trump is confident that the Russian leader is ready to make a deal to end the war in Ukraine. But as we hear from one of Trump's former advisors, Putin is skilled at sleight of hand.
President Putin can say, well, President Trump agreed with me on this, thus, and the other. Or President Trump and I discussed this when it's really just Putin talking about something and President Trump listening along.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, how extremist groups are taking advantage of the AI toolbox.
Overall, what we're seeing is kind of technological revolution that allows them to leverage AI to increase propaganda creation.
And a major development for Canadian hockey and U.S. schools.
You know, there's an expression that we abuse sometimes, that we use not correctly, but in this case, it's a true paradigm shift.
Coming up today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment in Greenland. We're glad you're with us today. Artificial intelligence is becoming more and more a part of our lives, solving problems and often saving time. And at the same time, there are serious concerns raised about ways that AI is being used and by whom. Experts are now warning that extremist groups across the globe are exploiting AI to create sophisticated propaganda and reaching even bigger audiences. The World's Shireen Jafari starts us off with this report.
Last March, a group affiliated with ISIS created a series of videos. They had fake news anchors and real-time screen tickers with the look and feel of CNN and Al Jazeera. The videos were downloaded and disseminated across the internet. They were all created using artificial intelligence. For extremist groups, AI is a new shiny tool in their toolbox, says Lucas Weber, a fellow at the Soufan Center.
They can change faces, voices, integrate coded language, and bypass kind of conventional automated filters and human moderators, which makes it much harder for governments, tech platforms, counterterrorism operatives, and so on to kind of identify and disrupt.
Weber says these groups are using AI in different ways. They're making professional-looking audio and visual content and translating propaganda into different languages. AI is even being used to improve instructions for making 3D-printed guns and drones.
Overall, what we're seeing is kind of technological revolution that allows them to leverage AI to increase propaganda creation.
More propaganda means more outreach and potentially more followers. For far-right groups, says Ghaffar Hussein, the goal is to build social ties around radical ideas.
They're trying to create a sense of, we are all one, we are white, British or American, and we just stick together, have a community, hang around with each other.
Hussein is an expert on radicalization and extremism. He says jihadi extremists are using AI tools with a different goal.
They're not necessarily trying to nurture a community. They're trying to just radicalize individuals so that small groups of individuals can go out and commit acts of violence or get involved in military operations.
Extremists have always been early adopters of new technologies, says Mustafa Ayyad. He's the executive director for Africa, Middle East and Asia at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
They recognized the capacity that the web had to expanding their reach, ultimately connecting people across geographies. The same with artificial intelligence and the tools at their disposal now.
A major appeal of AI for these groups is that it helps them remain anonymous. They can send out large volumes of propaganda and disinformation at a faster pace. Hussein says these groups are developing bots on social media to do their work for them.
So, for example, you can feed a bot, if you wanted to, with all the speeches and writings of, say, Osama bin Laden. And then this bot starts to think like that person.
And then when a user interacts with that bot, it responds with extremist ideas. AI also helps radical groups scan social media and find people who show sympathy towards certain ways of thinking. Hussein says that can be a starting point for recruitment, and it doesn't take much technical savvy to do it.
Anyone, anywhere can make highly sophisticated content that previously only, you know, rich, powerful news organizations would be able to make.
AI technology is advancing fast, he says, and tech companies have a big role to play in countering extremism online. Social media apps all have one goal, to keep users engaged. Click on one thing and the algorithm gives you more of that. But Hussein says this is exactly what amplifies extremist content.
So we've got a big problem on our hands because these are very powerful multi-billion dollar organizations that are more powerful than governments.
There is some good news. AI can be used against extremist groups. The technology can be deployed to catch keywords and trends, and it can collect data to better understand how radicals are using AI. Lucas Weber of the Soufan Center says the focus on this new technology shouldn't distract from the traditional ways extremist groups operate.
The fundamentals of terrorist groups, the physical fundraising, recruiting, attack planning and so on, these fundamentals remain and essentially make up the majority of the threat.
In other words, AI tools are not creating new threats. They're essentially turbocharging existing ones. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Hundreds of thousands of people around the globe are expected to see their flights canceled in the coming days. This as flight attendants for Canada's largest airline, Air Canada, prepare to walk off the job this weekend over stalled contract negotiations. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel joins us now for the latest. Where do negotiations stand, Jeremy? Why have flight attendants decided to strike?
Well, like most labor disputes, at the end of the day, this all comes down to money. The union representing the flight attendants, CUPE, or QP as it's called, say pay simply has not kept up with inflation. As an example, they say entry-level flight attendants' wages have only gone up $3 per hour since 2000, while inflation has increased by 69% in that same time frame. In a statement, the union told me their local offices have had to set up food banks for employees who can't afford groceries because of this.
Wow.
But then there's also a second piece, which is that as things currently stand, flight attendants at Air Canada aren't paid when the plane is not moving. So here's how one Air Canada flight attendant, Henley Larden, put it in an interview with the CBC.
So essentially, any time that the crew is assisting on board, whether that be safety-related briefings and or a medical emergency, everything leading up to the point where the wheels push back is unpaid. So until the wheels move, we are not paid. It could be hours.
Wow, that's amazing. Only paid when they're in the air. What is Air Canada saying about this?
So that's where things get a little bit complicated here. Neither side is disputing where things currently stand, but Air Canada says they've been faithfully coming to the negotiating table and that their latest offer is generous. It includes a 38% raise over 4 years, 25% of that right off the bat, and pay for groundwork. But the union says that still doesn't cover inflation and that the ground pay the airline is offering is only a fraction of their regular pay. So that's why we've reached this sort of tipping point where more than 99% of union members voted in favor of this strike and could walk off the job Saturday at midnight.
Mm.
And things have gotten kind of heated here. During a press conference I was watching this morning held by Air Canada, union members showed up holding signs that said in big red letters, "Unpaid work won't fly." And the airline ended up cutting the press conference short. Here's what that sounded like.
I'm asking QP one last time the question. Are you preventing us from continuing with that press conference?
Malheureusement, on va devoir s'interrompre. Je suis désolé pour les questions qui n'ont pas pu être posées. Unfortunately, we'll have to interrupt this press conference here. I'm really sorry about the questions that we have not been able to answer.
And you know, Marco, that included a question I was about to ask, which is whether other airline employees will continue to be paid in full if they have to ground all flights this weekend. I've followed up with the airline on that, but still have not heard back.
Jeremy, what does all this mean for people who have flights scheduled in the next few days, either on Air Canada or connecting flights?
Well, Air Canada has already begun canceling flights gradually in preparation for a full stop on Saturday. So today, they're canceling several dozen, tomorrow, hundreds of flights, and starting Saturday, all Air Canada flights, more than 1,600 daily, will not take off, which translates to roughly 130,000 customers a day facing canceled flights. And if this ends up happening, it'll probably last for a while. Air Canada says even if this strike comes to an end, it'll take at least a week to get things up and running again. Now, the airline is offering refunds to travelers, but, you know, Air Canada flies to 50 countries around the world, so people could end up stranded because of this situation.
Yeah, so if that is your situation, good listeners, check your alerts. The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel. Jeremy, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Marco.
Anchorage, Alaska finds itself in the global spotlight. It is the setting for President Trump to host Russian leader Vladimir Putin in a high-stakes summit tomorrow about Ukraine's future. The stakes are highest for Ukrainians.
We here in Ukraine, I think, share a lot of worries with regard to the upcoming meeting in Alaska.
Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze is a former member of the Ukrainian parliament. In a voice memo from Kyiv, she shared her thoughts with us about the summit.
It's also seen as a very strange move that without any concessions, without any pressure being exerted on Russian Federation, Putin has been invited to the United States for these talks. I think this reward of taking him from international Western isolation is not helpful in terms of really keeping pressure on the aggressor. And obviously, everybody is worried what kind of conversation that is going to happen in Alaska. But we are hearing about potential land swaps. Obviously, that is about Ukrainian territory. That's not something that Ukrainian society is going to agree upon. So we are hoping that Ukrainian position and Ukrainian view, together with our European partners, will be rendered to the American administration and will be taken on board by the United States of America, because playing the supposedly neutral facilitator in the discussion between evil and good in the black and white war that has been unprovokedly started by the Russian Federation, unprovokedly from Ukraine, it's something that is difficult to absorb here in Ukraine.
A voice of defiance there from Kyiv, but there are mixed opinions in Ukraine. Alex Zaitsev is a pastor who lived on the front lines of Donbas for the first years of this war until fighting forced him to flee to Western Ukraine. He is focused on the personal toll the war is taking.
Rather recently, my very good friend who was in the Ukrainian military. A drone hit his car. His car burned completely. His legs were very seriously hurt by shrapnel for about 24 hours. It was a very sketchy period when we were waiting to hear what's happening to him. Did he make contact with anybody? Did they find him? And then finally, he was delivered to the hospital. He had an operation done to remove the shrapnel in his legs, and he's recovering pretty well. But I understand that once he recovers completely, he'll probably be sent right back to the front line.
Despite that kind of grinding impact on fellow Ukrainians, Zaitsev told us he's conflicted about negotiating an end to the war.
On the one hand, we want the war to end, for the people to stop dying, for the bombing of our cities to stop. But on the other hand, we understand that, especially with Russia, very often a second war follows very soon. And it's a lot bloodier and a lot worse. We don't know what choice is better. You know, there's some people that say, well, look, you know, Trump was able to negotiate peace deals between Pakistan and India. He was able to negotiate, you know, these two countries, those two countries. So he'll be able to do it. Others are saying, well, no, this is Russia. You won't be able to accomplish anything, because the demands for Ukraine are way too big. Very mixed feelings.
Two views from Ukraine ahead of tomorrow's summit in Alaska. Later today on the show, I speak with Fiona Hill. She's a Russia policy expert who has been in the room with Trump and Putin and tells us what she'll be watching for when the two leaders meet tomorrow. Just ahead, we've got Canadian hockey news. Yes, in midsummer, because it's always hockey season in Canada. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Peru, the government passed a new amnesty law. It protects military and law enforcement personnel from prosecution for alleged human rights abuses during the country's civil war. President Dina Boluarte, signing the bill into law yesterday, said it was with great honor. Starting in 1980, Peru faced a violent insurgency led by a communist group, the Shining Path. An estimated 70,000 people were killed in the conflict that lasted for 20 years. Belligerents on both sides have faced allegations of human rights abuses, including torture, forced disappearances, and the killing of civilians. In an official ceremony, President Boluarte said that Peru honors those who fought against the insurgency with courage and dedication. We recognize their sacrifice and restore their dignity, she said. It never should have been questioned. Most support for the law comes from right-wing parties who have historically supported the military, including the Popular Force Party, led by Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori. Critics of the amnesty law say it undermines the effort to reach accountability for atrocities committed by the government. Congresswoman Ruth Luque was among a group of demonstrators protesting the law outside the Palace of Justice in Lima. It is yet another sign of contempt for the victims, Luque said. Many of those victims of the war came from the poorest families in the country and have been seeking justice for years. Human rights groups estimate the law will overturn more than 150 convictions and put a stop to 600 legal cases still playing out in the courts. Summer is winding down, so college athletes are starting to head back to campus. And this year, one sport in the U.S. college system, the NCAA, has a bunch of new players coming from one country in particular. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
For the past 50 years, the Canadian Hockey League, or the CHL, has produced some of the best junior players in the world.
The pride of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, up through center to Jordan Gustafson, has a goal tonight. He's crushed! Oh, what a hit!
From ages 16 to 20, these athletes compete across more than 60 teams, with many going on to the highest level of the sport, the NHL. In fact, most of the top picks in the last 25 years of the NHL draft have come from the Canadian League.
Pittsburgh Penguins select from Rimouski, the Quebec Major Junior League, Sidney Crosby.
But by lacing up for the CHL, hockey players have historically given up one big opportunity, playing college hockey in the U.S. in the NCAA. That's because CHL players earn a small stipend of a few hundred bucks a month. In the NCAA's eyes, that payment meant they are professionals and therefore ineligible for the college league. Until last November.
Last fall, the NCAA executives voted to change that rule allowing CHL players into the NCAA.
Scott Roblin covers the CHL for Global Saskatoon in Canada. He says this rule change came about in part because of the NCAA's 2021 decision to allow players to earn money from their name, image, and likeness, or NIL.
After name, image, and likeness came into effect, that really threw a wrench into everything else.
How could the NCAA argue that CHL players were making too much money when some of its own student athletes were making thousands?
I think they knew it wouldn't hold up in a court of law if it was challenged.
So starting this season, college hockey teams in the U.S. are going to get a lot more Canadian.
We look at our roster and the depth of it now. It's better than we've ever had because of adding CHL players to it.
At Arizona State University, head coach Greg Powers has added 7 CHL players to the team. In total, more than 150 CHL athletes have committed to U.S. schools, including Canada's biggest star, Gavin McKenna.
McKenna cuts, waits, has it on the back end. What a pass! What a goal! Oh, my
We are not worthy for what we just saw.
McKenna dominated during his time in the CHL, earning the Player of the Year award and the nickname McKenna Magic. But when given the chance, he left the league.
Gavin, you've been mulling over quite a big decision about colleges. Where are you headed to school next?
Yeah, it was a super tough decision.
17-year-old McKenna announced on ESPN last month that he's headed to Penn State, where he's expected to play a season, then become the number one NHL draft pick in 2026. His decision is fantastic news for the NCAA. Top talent could lead to more fans and money for the sport. Arizona's Coach Powers is even looking forward to having his team face McKenna at their season opener.
That game against Penn State, because of how world-class that kid is going to be probably the most watched hockey game in all of October, all over the world. Selfishly, it's a great thing for college hockey.
What's less clear is how this will impact the CHL if a bunch of its top talent heads south to the U.S.
We don't exactly know what's going to happen. There's lots of unanswered questions right now.
Dan McKenzie is the president of the CHL. He's quick to point out that the vast majority of the CHL players who have moved to the NCAA would have had to leave the Canadian League anyway due to their age. So it's not like everyone is jumping ship. In fact, McKenzie says the CHL has seen a significant increase in younger players since the rule change.
As of now, it's about 220 players have left the programs they were in and are now coming to play in the Canadian Hockey League.
Mario Cecchini, commissioner of the Quebec Maritimes Junior Hockey League, which is in the CHL, explains why.
There's no obstacle anymore for them to come play in our league where the caliber is very high, and then go on after their stay and play in the NCAA.
That, everyone agrees, is a major benefit of this rule change. Here's reporter Scott Roblin again.
Players, executives, coaches, agents, they all said that this is a good thing for hockey because it is giving players more autonomy and it is giving players opportunities to play where they want to play.
And both options have their advantages. The CHL boasts more games per season, preparing athletes for the rigorous schedules of the pro leagues. But the NCAA has world-class facilities, and top players could earn a ton in NIL deals. No matter which path these young athletes take, the ultimate goal remains the same: carving their names into NHL history. It's just a matter of how they get there. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Pink Fong might not have universal name recognition. You know this tune they're behind. Baby Shark is the most watched, by far, YouTube video of all time. Even if you've never actually clicked on the 2016 video, you'd have to be living under a rock not to have heard it. The massively successful Baby Shark song was the focus of a South Korean Supreme Court decision today, thus ending a six-year legal battle. An American songwriter known as Johnny Only filed a lawsuit in Seoul, accusing South Korea's Pink Fong of ripping off his 2011 version of the song. The court upheld two lower court verdicts that ruled against Johnny Only in favor of the company. I guess you can't keep a good Baby Shark down. Dorsal, you're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, Executive Editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Earlier this hour, we heard from some Ukrainians worried about what might transpire tomorrow in Alaska when President Trump meets face-to-face with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Fiona Hill is also watching closely. Hill is one of the very few people who has actually sat in the same room with both Trump and Putin, watching their interactions unfold up close in real time. She served on the National Security Council during Trump's first term and was his top advisor on Russia. She's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Fiona Hill spoke with us earlier today, and I asked her what she's paying attention to as the two men prepare to meet again.
Well, I think the problem, of course, is going to be that none of us are going to be inside that one-on-one. And we've got to hope that President Trump will take in a really good interpreter, U.S. State Department interpreter, who will also help him situate himself in the discussion, not just interpreting the words, but, you know, hopefully afterwards giving President Trump, if he takes the time to ask, some of the kind of context and the way that Putin's been using the language. Because that's really the risk here, is that because Putin has the command of English as well as of Russian, that Putin is the person who ends up dominating all of this sequence of events there and then basically betrays the whole meeting and all the conclusions in the way that he wants them to be taken on board by everybody else.
Well, your fundamental point about language, I think, is really, let's focus on that for a second, because Steve Witkoff, President Trump's special envoy, has broken with convention and relied on Russian interpreters during three high-level meetings with Putin. Do you know how President Trump is going to handle the language hurdle tomorrow? Like, is he going to bring his own fluent Russian speakers into the room?
I don't. And I mean, that's kind of my basic question, because I think what we're seeing from all of the reporting from Witkoff's encounters with Putin, it's either what the Russians are telling us, and it seems that many times Witkoff hasn't fully appreciated and understood or fathomed what Putin has said, because he's constantly having to walk back or to have the points clarified, or the Russians are saying, well, actually, no, that's not what was said. A good interpreter is basically like a psychiatrist or a priest or your doctor. You know, they're not meant to be speaking out afterwards or providing any kind of background information. But in circumstances which have such high stakes, as we're going to have in this one-on-one, it makes it, you know, really quite risky if you can't really trust the quality of the interpretation. And also then if you can't really be sure what has transpired and what has been said, then it's all just subject to the recall of President Trump. Can he really recall everything that was said? Or you're subject to the whims of someone like Putin, who's a master at bending the narratives. And President Putin can say, well, President Trump agreed with me on this, that, and the other. Or President Trump and I discussed this, when it's really just Putin talking about something and President Trump listening along.
When you've been in the room with both Trump and Putin, are there nuances that struck you about their dynamic and how they responded to one another's overtures that might come into play with this meeting in Alaska?
Putin is paying always extraordinarily close attention to people. He's given everyone a close study. And I don't think that we can say the same about President Trump with Putin. He hasn't necessarily been listening to advice about who Putin is and, you know, how you speak to him. I don't think this meeting, for example, has been murder boarded in the sort of sense of, you know, what would you say if he says this? President Trump tends to think that he can handle all of this because he feels that he can handle any interaction with anyone. But this is something very categorically different. Putin is somebody who is really quite expert at manipulating people. And I know Trump prides himself on the same thing, but he obviously isn't in the same category as Putin is. President Trump only really listens to people who he thinks are peers, and that's certainly not his staff. And even with European leaders, he doesn't quite see them at the same level as he is. So, I mean, this is something that I think, you know, sets us up for some problems. I think President Putin is hoping to divert him away from discussions of Ukraine onto issues related to nuclear weapons, because, you know, that's something actually, however, that President Trump is very interested in and is actually, I think, quite well versed in. But that isn't obviously pertinent to the immediate matter at hand, which is trying to put things on a different track in the war in Ukraine and, you know, to try to put that into the path of negotiation. And also what Putin is likely to do is give Trump yet again a spiel about Russia's rights to Ukraine, and almost, you know, running through the title to the Ukrainian property, if we want to put it in a real estate context. And Trump is very susceptible to then, you know, taking that angle of, you know, Russia's rights to this. He's done the same with China or North Korea or others in the past, because he tends to listen to the other leader and their version of events rather than, you know, what the actual facts of the matter may be.
I'm speaking with Fiona Hill about tomorrow's summit in Alaska. Fiona served on the National Security Council during President Trump's first term. So you've set the table for us. Let's talk about what's expected to happen. What are Trump's goals going into this meeting? Do you think he has a set of strategic objectives?
Well, yes. Trump actually does want to get a ceasefire and put everything on track for some eventual deal, peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. So he does want to set the table for real negotiations. And that's kind of the problem. That's not really what Putin wants to get out of this. I think President Trump also wants to reset the relationship between the United States and Russia, and also being able to talk about nuclear weapons and all the other things on that agenda. And I think what Putin wants to do is to kind of push Trump back onto that track again about the importance of the U.S.-Russian relationship and trying to, you know, kind of basically stop him from supporting Ukraine in some ways.
As to this fundamental idea of exchanging Ukrainian territory for peace, I mean, a few days ago, Trump said, even without Zelensky there or in consultation, it seems, that there will probably have to be an exchange of Ukrainian territory for peace. Yesterday, reversed that and said, no land for peace exchanges to some relief in Kyiv, it's been reported. Is Putin likely to make any sort of concessions?
No, he's not. And, you know, we're also hearing all kinds of rumors that President Trump is going to offer some kind of concessions to Russia for access to natural resources in Alaska, for example. I mean, he's trying, Trump, all kinds of concessions, as it were, to bring Putin into some, you know, agreement and to try to put him on another track. But there's no sign whatsoever that Putin is willing to give up on his maximalist aims. You know, at first it seemed that Steve Witkoff had come back from Moscow with an agreement from the Russians that they were going to basically withdraw from Kherson and Zaporizhia, and the Russians have made it clear, no, they haven't. And in fact, they think now that these are constitutionally part of Russia because they've declared so. And then, you know, the second part of these maximalist aims is to make sure that they have a say over the future direction of Ukraine and its security and policy, domestic, foreign, and otherwise. And so that is, you know, really the dilemma here. We actually have, you know, two conflicting sets of goals here. And I think President Trump has realized that, first of all, he can't hand Ukraine on a platter to Russia. The Ukrainians won't allow it. The Europeans don't want this either, because for Europe, this is pretty existential. Certainly for those countries that are closer to both Ukraine and Russia, this has all kinds of implications for their own territorial integrity and security. So there's no desire here to have Trump presiding over the salami slicing of Ukraine to satisfy and to feed Putin and Russia's ambitions. So there really is a lot of potential here in Alaska for mutual frustration, for Putin wanting things that he can't get and for Trump wanting things that he can't get either.
So there's a warrant for Putin's arrest on war crimes. The U.S. is not a signatory to that international court, but has in the past supported some of its work. You spoke about conventional diplomacy a moment ago, but on this point, how outside the norm is it that Washington has invited Putin onto U.S. soil when he has avoided travel elsewhere, lest he be arrested?
As you're pointing out, this is outside the norm. So this looks like it's a, you know, major incentive for Putin to come to Alaska. Obviously, there's all the symbolism about Alaska once being Russian territory, suddenly a Russian colony. Of course, Russia had colonies in California, in fact, until the 1820s. So there's a lot of kind of symbolism in this and a great import for Putin. And there's a lot of points that can be scored by the Russians by having this summit take place.
Well, tell us how we'll know if President Trump walks away from this meeting thinking he got a deal when, in fact, it might be Putin who benefited most. Will we know?
Well, we'll know after the facts, and we'll know what happens if they have a joint press conference and then as we, you know, pass things later. So, I mean, this could create actually all kinds of contention for Trump, both at home and, you know, with the European allies and with Ukraine. But again, you know, I think we should also hold out some hope that something actually happens there that does spur a real set of talks between Ukraine and Russia, not just with Trump acting as some intermediary or broker.
Fiona Hill served on the National Security Council during President Trump's first term and was his top advisor on Russia. She's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Fiona, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Marco. Great to be with you.
Negotiators in Geneva are gearing up for a long night. Their goal is to break a deadlock over the details of a global plastics treaty. During a press conference held at the start of the negotiations last week, the head of the United Nations Environment Program, Inger Andersen, said there is some 430 million tons of plastic produced globally every year, and that is a problem.
We know that plastic is in our nature, in our oceans, and yes, even in our bodies.
Today was meant to be the deadline for reaching a legally binding agreement to limit plastic production around the world, but so far it's been out of reach. Chris Dixon is observing the negotiations for the Environmental Investigations Agency. She says a large coalition of countries wanted to establish a global target for reducing how much plastic is produced.
Something similar to the 1.5 degrees target of the Paris Agreement, a kind of North Star for guiding our approach to reducing production.
That position did not make it into the draft treaty circulated last night. For a smaller group of countries opposed to a universal target, that is just fine, because most of those nations produce and export fossil fuels, a key ingredient in plastic manufacturing.
And the growth trajectory for the industry is expected to grow exponentially in the coming decades. And what we've seen is that those countries who rely on oil and gas and also now plastics are really concerned about the potential for regulation that might limit that potential for growth.
This is not the first time negotiations on a plastics treaty have run into hurdles. In fact, this round of talks is a continuation of discussions that began last year in Busan, South Korea. Those talks were supposed to be the big finale after years of preparation work aimed at finally setting limits on international plastic production. Ever jump on the old bathroom scale to weigh yourself only to find that it's broken or the batteries are dead? Well, there's a guy in Spain who makes a scale that, for better or worse, won't let you down, ever. The balances date back to at least the Roman Empire. From the village of Santibáñez de Béjar in central Spain, the world's Jerry Haddon brings us the story of the man keeping alive the practice of building precision scales.
Centuries ago, before fiat, that is, official paper money, wealth was measured in weight, and weight was measured on Roman balances.
Sí, era una cosa normal, se necesitaba tanto para la agricultura, para
These scales para were everywhere, says Manuel Jaén in his sunlit, cluttered workshop. They were needed for weighing crops, he says, or meat. People needed them for selling stuff in markets. Jaén, a ruddy 50-year-old, wears a fireproof apron. He holds a hammer in one hand and a glowing red iron bar in the other, as smithies do. He's demonstrating how to make the simple contraption that once defined global commerce. He heats up and pounds out the horizontal bar that acts as the balance's axis. He balances the bar on a vertical piece of metal, the fulcrum. On one end, he attaches hooks holding a metal bowl. He calibrates the scale by sliding a weight along the other side of the bar until it's balanced horizontally. When done, the scale will be dead accurate. Today or in 1,000 years, there are no springs to wear out here, no digital screen to go all wonky on you.
Lo que realmente estamos pesando es la fuerza de la gravedad.
What we're really weighing is the force of gravity, Jaén explains. Whenever the forces on both sides of the axis are in balance and the axis rests perpendicular to the fulcrum, you've ascertained the exact weight. It's pure physics. This balance is so reliable that the fulcrum, the tiny pivot point at the balance's center, bears that name, El Fiel, or roughly, the reliable. This design served emperors and merchants faithfully from Alexandria to Constantinople, and it's still used. This is a report on TikTok about potato farming in rural Colombia. In it, a farmer weighs his sacks on a Roman balance before sending them to market. The balance isn't Jaén's, but it could have been. Jaén exports his all over the world.
Por mediación de una distribuidora de Galicia, he mandado en lotes.
Through wholesalers, he says, I sell my balances in Cuba for sugar, in North Africa for weighing lambs. Farther south, buyers use them for cacao, coffee, charcoal. Artisanal fishermen even take them out to sea. Those are some of Jaén's more traditional clients, but he gets all kinds of odd requests, like the guy who came in just a few weeks ago needing a scale for his illegal cockfights, giving new meaning to the category featherweight. Jaén's even seen his scales on TV, though he swears he has no idea how they ended up on the news.
En el telediario, en más de una ocasión, he visto cuando la policía ha cogido...
You know, when the police make a drug bust and display all the cash, drugs, and weapons on a big table, a couple of times I've spotted our Roman scales among the contraband, scales that I made myself. If drug traffickers trust Roman balances, they must be accurate. Jaén can pound out about 1,000 balances a year. His largest scale can hold 450 kilos, that's nearly 1,000 pounds. His smallest weighs things in grams or ounces.
Las señoras, para pesar el azúcar, la harina a la hora de hacer dulces.
From time to time, women will come in to buy one for making pastries, he says, for weighing sugar and flour. They don't trust modern scales, he says. Back in ancient Rome, each town had its official set of weights, and there was a designated weight checker in the markets to ensure accuracy and to guard against what may just be humanity's first attempts at fraud. We agree to put one of Jaén's scales to the test. We set my Zoom audio recorder with batteries, windsock, and SD card in the balances bowl.
325 gramos.
Jaén slides a 100-gram weight out along the axis, does the numbers.
325 grams according to this balance system.
That's about 12 ounces. When I get home, I check my own digital scale against Jaén's Roman balance.
We are at zero. And let's see what my trusty Zoom weighs. Ladies and gentlemen, 315. Pretty close.
So modern technology is pretty accurate, but not as good as Jaén's.
El placer que te da buscar en cada romana.
It's the pleasure in achieving that moment of perfection, he says back in his workshop, knowing the job's well done. Looking for balance and peace, he says, isn't that really what we're all after? For the World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Santibáñez de Béjar, Spain.
Seeing how these scales are made is something else. We've got video of that for you on our YouTube channel. Check out how they move and how they compare to that modern scale in your own bathroom. Go to YouTube. We're at The World News GBH. And while you're there, subscribe to our channel. You'll never miss a beat. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For generations of refugees fleeing violence in their homelands, resettling in the United States has brought a new set of challenges. Vanna Howard knows what that's like, even without the current changes in asylum policy. She arrived here at the age of 11 from Cambodia in the early 1980s. She didn't speak a word of English and had to teach herself. But Vanna also suffered from more than just political violence in Cambodia. Years later, she channeled her life's pain into service and politics. Vanna Howard lives in Massachusetts, and she spoke about her experiences on GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage. And a warning, parts of her story involve descriptions of domestic violence and will be difficult for some listeners.
In 2012, I'm in downtown Lowell, Massachusetts, campaigning for the re-election of Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas and for Elizabeth Warren for the U.S. Senate. Suddenly, this former intern casually suggests I should run for state representative. I immediately say no. I said to him, public speaking scares me. And my English is not perfect. I don't tell him the whole truth, though. I was worried people will learn about my past. I am a Cambodian refugee. From 1975 to 1979, Cambodia was under the Khmer Rouge regime. I lost nearly all of my family members during that war, including my father, three youngest of my siblings, and both of my maternal grandparents. At one point, my mother even disappeared, and I find myself at 8 years old, all alone. I remember I was crawling under barbed wire searching for any food to keep me alive. After months later, my mom returned from being forced to work in a camp. My refugee background was not why I was worried about running for office. My bigger fear was that people would find out about my experience with domestic violence. Before we fled Cambodia to the refugee camp in Thailand, my mom remarried. And after we resettled to the U.S., my new father was very abusive to me and my mom. I watched him beat her often. And later, when I grew older, the whole entire 4 years in high school, it was a daily interrogation, a daily inspection. He would check my backpack, my notebooks, inspect my clothes. He would check my closet. I was not allowed to have friends. The only time I was allowed to go anywhere was just to go to school and with him. If he caught any boys talk to me, even on the street or down the street at a laundromat, he would hit me right then and there. And people just watch. Nobody did a thing. And so one night, I left home and moved in with a nice woman I come to know in a neighborhood. And eventually, I met a man and fell in love. And I thought he was my escape from the abuse. Unfortunately, I was wrong. He turned out to be just as horrific. For years, he abused me. Even when I managed to escape with our daughter, he stalked me, harassed me, threatened me. He would show up at my work, and I had to keep switching jobs. And even when I managed to escape, he followed me for the next 25 years. And on the worst day, he broke into my friend's house where my daughter and I were staying and hid in a closet. And when she left, he burst out from the closet and beat me so hard, I ended up in the emergency room. Eventually, I met a kind, loving man. It took me 4 months to say yes to him on a first date. My colleagues at work teased me that I brought my daughter on a first date. But he was so kind and loving to her. Eventually, we married. Throughout the years, the memories of Cambodia in my childhood and years of abuse haunted me. I tried to escape the pain by volunteering as many hours a week in the community, serving on nonprofit boards, commissions, to river cleanups, to park and street cleanups. I was always very comfortable being behind the scenes and out of the spotlight. But then the pandemic began, and I started to get calls from people urging me to run for office, just like that intern had. As I was out and about in the community delivering food and diapers, I witnessed and heard story after story of people struggling with food, with housing, with safety. I was resistant at first, again. And so I called my advisors. Ironically, it was a conversation with a man I consider a friend who changed my mind. He told me I shouldn't run. He said to me, "Don't waste your time. I was a woman and Asian." While people was talking about wanting change, but they don't really want it. But I realized I wanted change. And so I ran and eventually won. There was one moment that I will never forget. It was when I was standing inside Lowell City Hall at a white ribbon ceremony to raise awareness about domestic violence, telling my story for the first time to people who had known me for years. I was scared I would be judged if people knew my past, but this hasn't been the case. Instead, I have only expanded my community and now focus mostly on the future and hope that our children today will understand that our past don't have to be our future. Thank you.
Vanna Howard shared her experiences with the GBH program Stories from the Stage, produced by her colleagues at World TV. The election that Vanna won, by the way, representative in the Massachusetts legislature, she's served at the State House for the past 4 years. You can hear more personal stories at worldchannel.org. Vinyl records might be technologically antiquated, but hardcore collectors are just as obsessed as ever.
We have like all sorts of people coming in. We've got long-time collectors, first-time diggers, DJs, musicians, even curious passerbys.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with a record shop owner who just might be the biggest vinyl junkie in all of Dubai. You'll want to tune in for that. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks as always for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Curtis L. Scribner, Frank Washington, Leanne Hahn, Lizzie and Dan Routman, and Sarah and Stephen Bass. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.